Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's the weekly show about science and technology that makes complex topics accessible, amusing, and entertaining. At least that's our goal. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And good morning, Lynn. I'm John Wells. Our theme music this morning, it's not easy to dance to, but we managed, didn't we?
Absolutely.
Just play a couple of bars of that just for a second. Just play a little bit.
There we go.
I can't hear it. Okay.
It was enough. It was a couple of bars.
Okay.
You want more?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, today in the program, we're going to talk with O'Neironautics. A new word for you. It's certainly a new word for me. And the word, of course, is derived from an ancient language. And it's an ancient concept. It means navigating dreams. In other words, when you're in a dream and you know you're in it and you're able to navigate. Is this an art? Is it a science? We'll talk with the master, Jared Zeisel, about his new book, A Field Guide to Lucid Dreaming, Mastering the Art of O'Neironautics.
Then how about taking pictures that are three times the size of the moon? That would be quite the camera. In fact, it's a wide-field infrared survey explorer camera, or WISE as the acronym. It's finding asteroids, comets, and stars that have never been discovered before. And our second guest, Pedro Sevilla, manages the WISE program at one of the partner institutions that works on the satellite. It's right here in Utah at Utah State University. We'll speak with Sevilla in the second half of the program. And we'll also have today's cool story somewhere in there.
This is Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after this word from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Hey, Dave, when is the best time for a story?
Sunday mornings at 8:30.
Hi, this is Kathy.
And I'm Dave. We're co-hosts of The Story Mine. Tune in Sunday mornings right here at KPCW.
Experience the treasures of storytelling every Sunday morning at 8:30.
Jan, I think I'm falling for the show.
John, are you hurt?
Nothing a little fun can't cure.
Fall into Fun on Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m.
Find out on Fun Friday what to do this fall. Brought to you by All Seasons Adventures,
Park Silly Sunday Market,
Zermatt Resort and Spa,
and the Homestead Resort.
No hosts were hurt in the making of this ad.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host John Wells. Well, in dreams, you can be free of your physical body, leaving behind silly things like gravity. Who wouldn't want to go there? And how about if you could direct your dreams to elicit experiences, solve problems? Well, like a lack of gravity, wouldn't you want to learn how? Our first guest is a self-professed lucid dreamer who takes a modern look at O'Neironautics, or lucid dreaming. He says you can do things like encourage lucid dreaming by setting your alarm for 6 hours after bedtime. I've got to challenge him on this, because if I set my alarm for 6 hours after bedtime, I just wake up.
It'd be time to get up.
Yeah. So, but what he says is that's the perfect time to then wake up and go back to sleep. And that's the time that you can really encourage lucid dreaming. Well, this new book, A Field Guide to Lucid Dreaming, Mastering the Art of O'Neironautics, is a refreshingly practical guide to controlling your dreamscape. Jared Zeisel will be joining us by phone soon. He's on another interview. So in the meantime, let's define what lucid dreaming is. It's not interpreting dreams.
No, it's when you are in a dream and you know you're in it. And many people have experienced this a couple times. But what Jared and his comrades write about is a way to be able to elicit that environment where you are awake within your own dream and you're able to do whatever you want. You can sculpt the dream the way you want.
So let me ask you this, John, while we're waiting for Jared. Have you ever had those lucid dreams? I mean, I think we all have. We just don't know exactly what to do with them.
I have.
One of the things I notice is in my dreams, I'm able to do things that I can't do in a conscious state. Things like I'm able to speak a second language nearly perfectly, a language that in my conscious state I only have, you know, half command of.
That is bizarre.
Well, we've got Jared Zizel on the phone right now, and I think he can answer those questions. Good morning to you, Jared.
Good morning.
Well, while we were waiting for you to finish up your previous interview, we were going through times that we've had that we think we're dreaming lucidly. In other words, we believe that we are able to control our dreams. But how does it kind of look when it starts, when you're maneuvering through your dreams?
Usually when you have your first lucid dream, it's almost really exciting because, like, you've tried all these different tips and techniques to get to this point, and you're like, I'm finally here. I'm finally have it, like, awake in the dream world, and then you actually wake yourself up in real life. But we do have a bunch of tips on how to actually stabilize the dream. One of them actually being just yelling stabilize can help keep you in that lucid state. But when you get there, really it's as real as the world is right now. You can smell, you can taste, you can hear, obviously you can see stuff, you can feel stuff. It feels like you're sort of traveled to another realm.
Right. So how long has the concept of lucid dreaming been around, and how much do we really know about it? How much can we even define it as a science?
Well, lucid dreaming itself has been around for thousands of years. Ancient Egyptians and Aboriginal tribes of Australia and indigenous tribes of the Americas, they've all had lucid dreaming practices. It wasn't until sort of the late 1800s where the term lucid dreaming was coined. Early 1900s that the term lucid dreaming was coined. And then it wasn't actually until the 1970s where there were two scientists, Stephen LaBerge, who was working here in America, and Keith Hearn, who I want to say was working in the UK, but they both were doing experiments that were essentially giving scientific backing to lucid dreaming.
And I think, as you mentioned in your book, many cultures and many major religions, maybe with the exception of Christianity, all believe somewhere in their doctrine that lucid dreaming is a deeper state of reality.
Yes. Yeah, they look, you know, different cultures will look at it differently, but they do look at it either diving internally or going kind of having your consciousness leave the body and explore kind of another realm or another sort of state of mind.
Jared, I'll tell you what's bizarre is the Hindus. As you write in your book, there's this guy named Vishnu who apparently is having a dream, and Vishnu's dream is a manifestation of us, our world. And when Vishnu wakes up, it's lights out for everybody.
Yes, and I know there's actually in the Hindu text there's a lot more that kind of dives into that. But yeah, essentially what you said is true, and really I think it helps frame how we can look at dreaming. Vishnu kind of dreamed us into existence. You know, what can we dream into existence, and what can we experience, and what world can we create?
Jared, so humans have up to 40 to 50,000 thoughts per day. And so it's no wonder, right, that our dreamscape is all cluttered. And sometimes we'll be operating in a dream and we think that we're controlling it, and then boom, within a split second, you're dreaming some completely other topic on a remote island, right? So let's talk a little bit about how you said you use the word stabilize. How do you stabilize a dream that you're in that you want to manipulate, a problem you're trying to solve?
Well, with the more lucid dreams you have, the more you feel familiar with kind of exploring that dream state and can alter or influence the dream, and kind of if something sort of essentially comes into the dream, one of those random thoughts that you don't want there, and you can sort of push it away. Some of the actual like techniques to do that when a dream starts to get fuzzy or fade is, like I said, you yell stabilize, and that kind of helps essentially stabilize the dream. And you know, it's a little funny in the dream itself. You're just yelling this word over and over, but that's my favorite way to stabilize the dream. Another way is actually just spinning in a circle, and it was scientist Stephen LaBerge who discovered that, and realized, like, you know, you spin in a circle, the world kind of blurs, and you ground yourself a bit, and some of that kind of excitement or possibly disorganization that you're experiencing while lucid kind of melts away for a moment, and you can find your footing in the dream world.
So the lucid state can be fragile, and this is a way of stabilizing.
Yes, and I will say, like, anyone who can dream can have a lucid dream, but to remember, you know, if a beginner lucid dreamer, you know, lucidity is on a scale, so it might not be the most crystal clear lucid dream. It takes a little bit of practice, but eventually, you know, you can have very, very lucid dreams that feel as real as this world.
So practice makes perfect. What are some of the other practices in your dreamscape or maybe in your waking state that you do?
One thing we tell everyone is to always keep a dream journal.
Mm-hmm.
That is the best way to sort of stay connected with your dreams, and by kind of building sort of a relationship with the dream and the ones that you're having, these experiences, you're putting an importance on having dreams and remembering your dreams. And that is a reminder to your mind that this is something you want to do. Another thing that we tell people to do during the waking day is to sort of throughout the day ask themselves, am I dreaming? And, you know, you ask that to yourself right now, you're like, oh, like, of course I'm not dreaming. I'm at my job right now. But you want to, by asking it over and over and over again, you condition your mind to essentially ask it when you're in the dream. And then you might ask it in the dream, and you'd be like, wait a second, this is a dream. And then you've become lucid.
From practicing in reality, when you're in your dream, you may do it as well. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
You know, when our producer contacted us a little while back and said, "Would you like to talk to you about this book?" You know, I was certainly curious. I thought it was an interesting topic, but I thought it was kind of new agey. And when I got the book, I was interested to learn that many cultures, that lucid dreaming has become a fundamental piece of many cultures, and also, it's not just a new agey thing that's, you know, people write books and talk about, but Stanford University is doing some major research. People are talking about this as a state of consciousness that really needs to be explored, and there are a number of facilities around the world that are studying this. Can you talk about that?
Sure, and actually, yeah, Stanford is sort of one of the sort of beginning points of the scientific approach to lucid dreaming, because it was in the late 70s that Stephen LaBerge did this experiment where essentially he would become lucid, and he would go into the dream state and become lucid, and when you're in that state, your body is paralyzed except for your diaphragm, so you can breathe, and your eyes. And we know of REM and sort of the rapid eye movement. And he was able to go into that dream and look back and forth, right to left, right to left, right to left, and have one of another scientist observe his eyes. And they saw his eyes move back and forth. And they did this experiment over and over again and with different people. And he wrote the first sort of peer-reviewed article that proved that lucid dreaming was possible through this eye movement that he could control.
So we've got it going on at Stanford University. We've got some scientific backing, as you say. But then there are the purely anecdotal ones. And I just have to ask you about this book I read about 30 years ago by Richard Bach. No doubt, as a lucid dreamer, you have read. I can't think of what the name of the book is. But do you know where I'm going with this? Where he meets his, it's an autobiographical book, and he meets his partner, you know, his girlfriend or wife in the dream, and they come out of the dream and they have had a similar experience. So if you're not familiar with the book, maybe you could just comment on that, on meeting someone in the dream and then in your waking state having compared stories and had the same story.
It's actually a very interesting realm, and this starts to kind of step into the stuff that we haven't proved yet, such as shared dreaming and where we're actually going when we have a dream. And personally, I do believe that that when we dream, we go somewhere, we're tapping into something we just don't have fully understand, or that we don't have the capabilities of sort of measuring in a quantifiable way. But when I was writing the book with Dylan and Thomas, we had finished the first draft, and we took a retreat to a small cabin to start actually like reading through the whole thing again and seeing if it made any sense. And we wanted to try a couple like shared dreaming experiments. And so we all went to bed with the intention to have a shared lucid dream. And then we woke up. We did a technique called a wake back to bed, where you wake up for you go to sleep for 6 hours, and you wake up, get a little bit of sort of awareness and consciousness going, and then you go back to sleep, and that makes lucid dreaming easier. So we did that, and we didn't have the same lucid dream, we all didn't end up in the same room and just like, oh, hey, how's it going? We all had very similar elements of the dream. There was Tom dreamt of jumping through a stained glass window. Dylan ended up, oh, I'm drawing a blank on it, but he saw all this broken glass when he arrived to the dream state. And I had this dream where a motorcycle had crashed and there was fiberglass everywhere. So I can't say, you know, if scientifically that we all went to the same place or whatnot, but, you know, I think it sort of begs for a little bit of probing as, you know, as we go into the future.
Right. So it's, you know, that really speaks to collective consciousness, that we're communicating on some other level. I wanted to ask you finally, you must have some great anecdotes about your own lucid dreaming since you've mastered it. Can you give me one or two stories about that?
Sure. I'd be happy to. So one of the most, I guess, powerful or interesting dreams I've had is it occurred during a time where my brother and I, we weren't fighting, but there was a strong disconnect between the two of us, and whatever he was doing kind of annoyed me and stuff, and I was, like, pushing him away. And he would appear in my dreams, and I would kind of just brush it off like it wasn't important. But then I had a dream where he got shot, and I was like, oh, no, I got to take care of him. Like, even though we're not getting along, he's still my brother. And at one point when I'm going, and actually I'm not lucid at this point, and so I'm bringing him to the hospital, and we end up in this weird kind of dreamlike hospital, and all these sort of, like, thugs or, like, kind of monsters almost come in, and they start shooting, and then he goes, like, he says something to the tune of, like, this is not, like, the right hospital. And I realized, like, wait a second, this isn't, like, even a real hospital, we're in a dream. And I remember someone shot a bullet, and I was watching it go in slow motion towards my brother, and I caught the bullet. And I was like, we're in a dream, like, let's, like, fight these guys off. So the two of us teamed up and fought these sort of monsters away, and it was kind of this epic climactic battle. And then my brother disappeared, and I actually went for a fly around my hometown, and I remember feeling so free, and, like, this weight had been lifted. And when I woke up, I thought to myself, now that was, like, an amazing dream. And really, like, I had been pushing my brother away, but by pushing him away, I've been putting this, like, weight on my back. But when I welcome him in and reconnect with him, then
you could fly.
That's where the freedom is.
That's a great lesson for your conscious time, your awake time to take into your dreamscape. That's good. Well, Jared Zeisel, thank you so much for your time today. Jared is the co-author of A Field Guide to Lucid Dreaming, Mastering the Art of Onironautics. And did we say that correctly?
You got it perfect.
I think so.
Okay, very good. Thanks so much, Jared.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, that was Jared Zeisel in the book, A Field Guide to Lucid Dreaming, Mastering the Art of Onironautics. I like that idea. And also about keeping the dream journal, it's important to do that within moments of waking up, because as we know, we're very close to our dreams when we're in them and right after we wake up, and then they escape us during the day.
That's right.
Sometimes there's a little din in the head, something that triggers the dream again. So at some bizarre point during the day, and you go, oh, yes, last night I dreamt.
Well, that happens to me, too. But what typically triggers it is when my head hits the pillow the next night, all of a sudden I start thinking of what I had dreamt the night before.
Ah, do you? And does that ever propel you back into the same dream?
I've gone back into the same dream before, but not on different nights. Certainly within a single night I have, but not, you know, the next night or two nights later.
Right, right. So, and I didn't get the opportunity to ask him about that second language thing, the quandary that I had where in my dream I can speak the second language much better than I can, you know, say I'm speaking French. I can speak it much better in my dream than I can when I'm conscious and awake. And what that tells me is that the knowledge is that we have so much knowledge in our unconscious brains that can come out. We need to give ourselves credit for that, or just learn how to access it a little better.
Yeah. If we had more time with Jared, I was going to ask him something related to that, where he and his two comrades that he wrote the book with stated that they believe the unconscious brain accounts for all of our imagination. And I wanted to know if that was rooted in scientific study.
Right, because certainly we know that when we are daydreaming, and we know that the time that we're most creative and our imagination is most engaged is not necessarily when we're asleep, but in that, what is it called, the state where we're in, where we're just sort of daydreaming or we're very tired.
Right, between consciousness and unconsciousness, that you're sort of in the ether.
Right, the ether. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after this word from our underwriters with Pedro Sevilla. He is a researcher and software engineer at Utah State University. He also manages the WISE program. We'll talk to him about widespread infrared space Explorer telescope. There we go. We'll be right back.
That was good.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves Chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly at 5:30 p.m. You can contact us at 649-3140. Our website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. If you could imagine an astronomical telescope that orbits the Earth, photographing millions of objects, finding stars that are closest to the sun, comets, 35,000 asteroids, bizarre near-Earth objects, Where would such a telescope come from? Well, it comes from NASA, but our next guest is from Utah State University, which is a partner institution that works on the WISE project. WISE is an acronym, stands for Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. And now joining us by phone is Pedro Sevilla, researcher and software engineer at Utah State, to tell us about this powerful space camera. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be on your show.
Yeah. Pedro, what is Utah State's role in this exciting program?
Okay, so I actually work for the Space Dynamics Laboratory, which is owned by Utah State University. So we are basically part of the university. And we've been around for over 50 years. We built thousands of payloads that have gone into space, from sounding rockets to payloads that have gone on the space shuttle, many telescopes for Department of Defense, NASA. So we've actually been doing this for quite a while.
And what is your specific role?
So my role specifically on the WISE program, I started as a software engineer. Whenever you build something that flies into space, you have to do a lot of testing on the ground. You only get one shot. So my role was to write all of the ground software that was used to test and calibrate the instrument on the ground. Then I participated in a lot of the integration and testing. Once you have all the pieces, you got to put them together and test them. So that was another one of my roles. And then towards the end, once the satellite was launched into space, then I became the mission operations contact at the Space Dynamics Laboratory.
So at the Space Dynamics Laboratory, Pedro, is that also in Logan, or is that?
Yes, we're actually only a couple of miles north of the USU campus. It's what's called the Innovation Campus. It's in North Logan.
Okay. So when you have a NASA project like this, and I think I read something like $460 million went into this, you've got all of these partnering institutions. I know Berkeley was one of them. There's just a handful of other ones. So is it that each institution works on their own specific area of expertise, and then it all hopefully comes together with one product?
Yeah, that's correct. And it actually starts long before we get a contract. I mean, we actually all, somebody has to come up with an idea. Somebody has to say, hey, I have this great idea, and I know what needs to be done to carry out this idea. I want engineers to tell me how to build this telescope in this case. And so before you can even get a contract from NASA, you have to make sure that you get the right partners involved. And that was the case. In the case of WISE was, as far as the satellite goes, was composed of two parts. One of them was the spacecraft, which was built by Ball Aerospace in Colorado, and then we built the actual telescope, the infrared telescope. JPL was managed the mission. That's out in Pasadena.
Right.
And then Caltech was in charge of processing the data. So we were all partners long before we got the contract. We actually had to write a proposal, which was actually it was actually declined the first time around, and then 3 years later we proposed it again, and NASA decided to fund it.
Now, Pedro, there's a couple of other infrared missions happening in space. One is the Spitzer Space Telescope from NASA, and the second is the European Space Agency infrared Herschel, I think is the
correct,
name of
yes.
it. How is WISE different in what you look at and what you analyze and what you report?
Okay, that's an excellent question, because there are many different kinds of telescopes. Not every telescope can perform every mission possible. So, for example, a telescope like Spitzer, which was launched back in 2003, it's a fairly large telescope, fairly large, much more expensive than WISE. By the way, which WISE cost $320 million, just a minor correction.
Okay, just by $100
million. Yeah, just a few million. but anyway, so my point is Spitzer's mission was a lot different. Spitzer, because it was a bigger telescope, it tended to look at a smaller piece of the sky. So imagine that you have, if you're into photography, if you have a camera and you have different lenses, WISE, in fact, the first word in WISE, in the acronym WISE, is wide field. The reason for that being is that you're actually taking a picture. Every time you take a picture, you're actually taking a picture of a larger area of the sky. Spitzer, where it was a bigger telescope, it was a bigger lens, then it was taking a smaller picture. Now, granted, Spitzer's resolution is a lot better. It can actually see deeper into space. It can see more details. In the case of WISE, WISE was what we call an all-sky survey. And what that means is you want to take a picture of the entire sky. Well, it turns out that if Spitzer were to do an all-sky survey, it would have taken, I believe someone calculated, it would have taken 77 years to do a survey of the sky. So WISE's specific mission and primary goal was to map the entire sky in 6 months, in the infrared, and Herschel was also a bigger telescope, so it's the kind of telescope that you point at certain places in the sky. So what you do is you take the all sky survey created with the WISE data, and then you find something interesting, and then you say, okay, Spitzer, I want you to look at this particular region of the sky with Spitzer.
Well. Talking about looking into deep fields, and here's another acronym, ULIRG, which is ultra-luminous infrared galaxies. The WISE satellite, the WISE telescope, has been able to take a look at these objects, which are, and I think this is important to understand, that shine with up to a trillion times the energy of our sun, but it's virtually absent from visible light surveys. So something like the Hubble telescope is looking at visible light type objects, and that's why we have an infrared telescope, because they're looking at frequencies that are not in the visible realm. And tell us about these ULIRGs.
Okay, so the ULIRGs are extremely, as you mentioned a minute ago, they're extremely bright. But they're also extremely far, far away. They are billions of light years away. And I believe 90% of the light emitted by these ULIRGs is actually in the infrared. And so as you probably know, you may have something that's very, very bright, but the farther away it is, the harder it is to see. Now, in this case, the ULIRGs are also emitting visible light, but you just can't see it because it's so weak. But their infrared signature is very large, and so we're able to pick that up with WISE. And in fact, some of the longer wavelength detectors on WISE were designed to detect ULIRGs.
So, Pedro, is there a way to, in layman's terms, describe how infrared works in order to see what you can't see?
As you well know, we humans see with our eyes in what we call the visible spectrum. That's the spectrum between roughly 400 to 800 nanometers, or 0.4 to 0.8 microns, a micron being a one millionth of a meter. So in the visible light, we're used to seeing different colors. We're used to seeing blue, green, red. Each one of those colors is a different wavelength of light. And the blue is on the shorter wavelength, and the red is on the longer wavelength. Now, as you continue on the, if you think of it as a line that goes to the left and to the right, if you continue going to the right to longer wavelengths, then you run into the infrared, which we cannot see with our eyes. And every object in the universe emits some sort of infrared light, because infrared light comes from heat. And even though you may think that, say, 100 degrees below zero Fahrenheit is cold, I mean, us in Utah are used to, say, 0 degrees or maybe minus 10 degrees in the winter. We think that's extremely cold.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that even at 0 degrees Fahrenheit, there's a lot of infrared energy being emitted by bodies, even the mountains, that are 0 degrees in the winter, they're still emitting infrared light. And you can pick that up with special infrared detectors.
Okay. That you broke that down pretty well. Thank you for that. So, you know, if we go back to when the WISE's its initial mission was in 2009, is that right?
It was launched on December 14th. So most of the mission actually happened in 2010.
Okay. Okay, so take us through kind of what you found on the mission, what it found, and if it was a successful mission.
It was, first of all, let me tell you, it was extremely successful. It actually met every single goal that it set out to do. There were certain goals that the astronomers, the scientists had set out. One of them was the all-sky survey, which we completed successfully. We mapped, I believe it was like 99.99% of the sky.
Wow.
In the first six months of the mission, and then the coolant that was necessary to keep the telescope cold, it actually ran out. It started running out about 3 weeks after it completed the survey. So it continued. It actually completed the entire survey of the sky, and then it actually continued for another 3 weeks. And even longer than that, actually. And if you want to know a little bit about NEOWISE, I could probably go into it later. But we actually ran it for another 6 months. We actually did two complete surveys of the sky in the infrared. And another goal was, like John mentioned, the EULERCs. They have found many EULERCs. Another one was brown dwarfs. Brown dwarfs are failed stars. These are stars, unlike our sun, that don't actually burn like hydrogen like the sun. They're much smaller. They're in the order of, say, 2 to 5 times the size of Jupiter, but they just don't have enough mass to burst and burn.
So are they not as detectable then?
Well, they are in the infrared, but not in the visible.
Right. In order to see visible light, you have to be, I can't remember what the cutoff is, but it has to be pretty hot. I mean, several hundred degrees before you start emitting your own light. I mean, us humans don't emit our own light. We reflect light because we're not warm enough. So we discovered hundreds of brown dwarfs. These are we actually even discovered a new category of brown dwarfs because they're so cold. And in this case, when I say cold, it's in terms of stars. So, for example, we found one that was about room temperature, about 80 degrees Fahrenheit. It's the coolest known brown dwarf in the universe.
So that was
another goal of WISE. Then there's the asteroids. We observed 130,000 asteroids. We found 34,000 new asteroids. Those were all goals that were set out by the scientists. And they've actually found other things that they didn't anticipate finding. Objects were not known before. Some of them are nicknamed hot dogs and mad cows. So these are actually new objects that we didn't know existed.
And there may be some more things to come, because I believe it's going to take you a while to analyze all the data.
Exactly. And the fact of the matter is that WISE was operated for 1 year, but yet most of the discoveries have happened after WISE was put into hibernation, because there was a lot of processing that took place. Unlike your typical CCD camera, where you take a picture and you can look at it and it looks pretty, the pictures from WISE, when they come down from the spacecraft, they don't look great. There's a lot of processing that goes into making these images pretty,
right,
and also into finding objects. You can't look at on a typical WISE image, there were 3,000 to 5,000 stars. So how do you find an asteroid amongst 3,000 to 5,000 stars? Well, what you do is you have supercomputers that actually detect these things. They use algorithms, and they find asteroids, and they find brown dwarfs and such.
So Pedro, I have a question for you. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Alpha Centauri wasn't that the closest sun that we thought was to Earth?
Actually, as of right now, the Alpha Centauri system is still the closest star system to the sun. And there's actually a one that's called Alpha Proxima, which is in the same system as Alpha Centauri, which is about 4.2 light years away. The closest star that we've discovered with WISE was, I believe it's on the range of 6 light years away.
Right. So the question I have is there a brown dwarf that is between Centauri and us?
If there is, we haven't found it yet.
So this is a mass of gas that is not ignited, so it's not in the visible light spectrum.
Correct.
But so, there's a tremendous amount of energy, and you can see it in the infrared spectrum.
That's correct. So like I mentioned, there was the one cool star, the cool brown dwarf, which is about room temperature. Yeah. An object at room temperature emits a lot of infrared light, but it does not emit any visible light whatsoever. You could point Hubble at it, and you could not see it because it does not emit any visible light.
Hmm. Pedro, how far into space was WISE launched? Where did it sit?
Okay, WISE was launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in what we call a sun synchronous orbit, which is an orbit that takes it from the North Pole down to the South Pole around that direction. Its original altitude was 525 kilometers, which is about 320 miles. In the 4 years since it was launched, it's decayed maybe 10 miles or so. So it's still up there about 310 miles, still orbiting.
Okay, so it's still orbiting, and you say at some point it ran out of coolant. So how do you make repairs? And how does it continue to operate with no coolant? Because, I mean, that's a big part of keeping it cool and keeping the radiation down, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what happened is on WISE we had 4 cameras. They were each different wavelength camera. So they each saw different things out there, different colors, different objects. Two of the cameras, we call them short wavelength cameras. Those were closer to what we see with our eyes, 3.4 and 4.6 microns, micrometers. The other two were the long wavelength cameras. They were in the 12 to 25 micron range. It turns out the longer wavelength cameras, they needed to be operated at about minus 450 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's why we had the coolant.
Mm-hmm. So the coolant was some sort of solid form of hydrogen, or what did
exactly.
you use?
Exactly. It's a solid hydrogen, okay. which is kind of a unique substance to use to cool telescopes, but yes. So our long-wave focal planes, they needed to be run at minus 445 Fahrenheit. And so once the coolant ran out, very quickly those two cameras stopped working, because they were overwhelmed by their own heat.
Right.
Even at minus 400 Fahrenheit, it was too warm for those cameras to see anything. They were overwhelmed. They just saturated. Now, the two shortwave cameras, they were originally running at minus 400 Fahrenheit. But then it turns out these two cameras, they can actually run warmer. So by the end of the mission in January of 2011, the telescope had warmed up to a balmy 326 degrees below zero. And it turns out those two cameras were still working.
Wow.
And they were still performing 95% as well as they did before. And in fact, the last 4 months of the mission were in this warm state. And so we know that these cameras still work at minus 325 degrees Fahrenheit. And so we know that we can turn it back on and resume operations.
Pedro, there's something very exciting that came out of the WISE project, besides all of the asteroids and the brown dwarfs and Eulergs, all these other things. But I understand that all stars have infrared heat around them. But one star in particular, Vega, had an extraordinary amount of infrared heat that you were able to detect. What is the mystery there? What is going on Vega?
John, honestly, I'm not sure, I am aware of what you're mentioning. I mean, Vega is a very bright star in the visible. So I guess I'm not familiar with that particular aspect.
Well, I was reading something else on the WISE, and they said that Vega had a tremendous amount of infrared heat surrounding it, and astronomers took a look at it with visible devices, including the Hubble, and they found pulverized rock around that star or something. And I don't know what that had to do with increasing the infrared, but it was kind of a mystery for a while, as I understand it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. My guess is I'm sure we saw Vega with WISE, but I'm guessing Vega was probably too bright for WISE. WISE is a very sensitive telescope, and even looking at Jupiter or Saturn, it was too bright for WISE.
Hmm. Okay. Well, let's talk for a minute about asteroids. So 34,000 asteroids were found, and, you know, I think in popular culture, we know about asteroids because occasionally they touch down on planet Earth, right? And we have lots of movies about them and that sort of thing. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what you found with asteroids and, you know, predictions for how close they're going to be to our planet.
Okay, so as you mentioned, WISE discovered about 34,000 new objects, most of them being asteroids, of course. Most of them were out in the main belt, which is between Mars and Jupiter. But we did find, we did discover 135 near-Earth asteroids. These are asteroids that come within a few million miles of Earth's orbit. And actually, a few of those discovered by WISE are actually considered potentially hazardous asteroids. These are asteroids that come even closer to the orbit of the Earth, and so those are all being tracked. We know their sizes, we know their composition, and they're all being tracked. And one of the reasons for waking up WISE and reusing it for the next 3 years is to continue finding these potentially hazardous objects and to keep track of them.
So while we have telescopes like the James Webb Telescope that's being developed right here in Utah, and it will be launched a million miles into space, and it'll tell us a lot about deep space, you know, maybe the WISE is a telescope that gives us more, tangible information about what could really affect us, you know, in a big way in terms of an asteroid.
Right, yeah. I mean, the James Webb Telescope is a replacement for Hubble.
Right.
So the James Webb Telescope is the one that 10 years from now is going to show you just the most absolute wonderful, beautiful pictures. But yes, it's not. Its purpose is not to look asteroids. And in fact, it's looking, being a million miles away and looking into outer space, it's probably not going to detect any asteroids. So WISE, because it's orbiting the Earth and because it's doing an all-sky survey, it's looking at everywhere in the sky. If there's an asteroid that happens to cross the field of view of the telescope, WISE will pick it up.
Huh.
And typically what happens is if this is something that has to happen quickly, unlike U-alerts and brown dwarfs that don't move,
mm-hmm.
whenever WISE finds an asteroid, the information is passed along to the Minor Planet Center out in Massachusetts, and they actually send out an alert to other telescopes around the world, to amateur astronomers, to actually observe this particular asteroid, so they can figure out what its orbit is, and that's how you know you can keep track of asteroids. Is you can't just look at it once and say, oh, this is a new asteroid. You actually have to look at them many, many times, so you can determine their orbit and find out if it's hazardous to us humans.
And the collaboration with other observers just makes it perfect.
Absolutely, and like I said, this involves a lot of amateur astronomers. There are actually a lot of people out in their backyards at night using their 12-inch telescopes, and they actually find a lot of asteroids themselves. But in this case, WISE was able to find, you know, thousands of them. But again, it was a joint effort with other big telescopes and small telescopes.
Well, Pedro, we want to thank you very much for being on our program this morning. Pedro, who works in the WISE program, which is the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, a very successful program of observation in the infrared spectrum. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Pedro.
Thank you.
Well, this is Cool Science Radio. We'll be back with today's cool story when we return.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Curtis Graff, 20 years building custom Park City homes, parkcitybuilder.com. Victory Ranch and Conservancy, 435-785-5000, victoryranchutah.com. Done to Your Taste Catering, 15 years perfecting life's celebrations. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and contributing listeners like you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, have you ever wondered about, since we're talking about satellites, how about the ones that Google Earth employs to look at us and everything we do? You know, mostly it's for a great reason. I mean, how many of us now use Google Earth for a variety of applications, but also just for navigation, GPS, all that stuff. But I read some funny stories about what you can see from up there when you really zero in.
Yeah, and you can get in trouble with this stuff. that story you told me this morning about a gentleman who was keeping his eye on his wife's smoking habits, and she said she had quit smoking, and he went to Google Earth and kept expanding and enlarging, and found her on the terrace of her workplace smoking
having
a cigarette.
Having a smoke.
Having a smoke.
And I don't think he was spying on her. It was in response to I think it was in the Netherlands, someone spotted a place where they thought a crime had been committed because there was this huge blood stain. Uh-huh. It was near a lake, and someone was looking at the lake, and then they saw this little patio on the side of the lake with this big blood stain and then dripping blood going off. And he encountered that, and he thought, well, that's curious. I wonder what I could see in my world.
Right.
It turns out that the crime wasn't a crime at all. It was a wet dog getting out of the lake and onto the deck, dropping a lot of water in one spot and then walking down the dock.
Wow.
But what I did find is that it prompted me to look at, I found an article about some of the most interesting things that are found by Google Earth. And one of those is the world's largest island in a lake on an island in a lake on an island. Got that?
You know,
it's a narrow 4-acre strip of land in Canada. It's way north. It's on near Victoria Island, which is not Vancouver Island, but it's way north. And they figure no one's ever touched down on this island in a lake on an island in a lake on an island. But hey, if you have Google Earth to show you those kinds of things, how great.
Now, keep in mind that it's not real time, that anything you see is a static picture that was taken at some time in the past. I don't know if it was last week or it could have been a year ago, but it's not a real-time view of what's happening.
Right, and we don't really know. I think it depends on where it is, and I don't think it's anything static. It's always changing how real-time it is.
Right.
So one other thing, quickly. Hamad bin Hamdan Al Nahyan, who's a billionaire sheikh and a member of Abu Dhabi's ruling family, has had his name carved into the sandy surface of an island that he owns in the Persian Gulf. Now, he has his name, Hamad, H-A-M-A-D. It's 2 miles long, and the letters are each a half mile tall, right? And so they decided it's the world's largest word. Hamad. visible from Google Earth, pretty readily visible from Google Earth.
So, that would be bigger than the PC on that mountain we're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's thank our guests, Pedro Sevilla and also Jared Zeisel, for coming on the show today.
And we also want to thank our underwriters, 350 Main, The Spur Bar and Grill, and of course our producer, Beth Fracken.